Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Lawrence Wright, whose new book is titled Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. This is the eighth book by Lawrence Wright. Other books include The Looming Tower, which won the Pulitzer Prize and is about the rise of Al-Qaeda, God's Favorite, which is a novel, Twins, Saints and Sinners, City Children, Country Summer. Also, Lawrence Wright is the author of a play titled Falaci, about Arianna Falaci, the famous interviewer. It's playing through April 21st at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley. Let me start by asking about a comment you made, I think it was in the New York Times, where you said that all of your books and all of your work have a connection, that they all are of a piece. What exactly is the piece that all of your work is about, do you think?
Well, in terms of what my work is about, I guess that I've always been drawn to powerful beliefs and how they transform individual lives. Religious beliefs especially have that kind of power. I think religion is far more influential in personalities and in societies than political beliefs, because political beliefs can be passive. And you have a political belief, but it doesn't necessarily mean you act on it. But if you are a member of a powerful faith group, oftentimes that defines really who you are and how you are in the world. And it's only belief that does that. I mean, it's not a you're not separated from the rest of society by a language or an ethnic distinction. You know, it's simply the belief. And I find that really amazing. And as a reporter, I've, you know, spent a lot of time looking at, you know, like the rise of radical Islam, a good example. You know, these are societies that are in absolute convulsion because of powerful religious beliefs. You look at the newspaper, you see the Catholic Church being torn apart right now. These are things that dominate not only the headlines, but the lives of billions of people.
Was the first inkling that this would wind up being, in a way, your life work, was that the work on Saints and Sinners back in the early 90s?
My first book was about the Amish, as a matter of fact. It was called City Children, Country Summer, and it's about mostly black and Latin kids from New York City and the Bronx and Harlem, and they were going to live with Amish and Mennonite dairy farmers in Pennsylvania. And I was absolutely captivated by the culture of the Amish. It's like, you know, a 17th century farm life. You know, they've ruled out the kind of the mechanical modern world. And it's a very beautiful community in many ways, although extremely fanatical. We think of them as being harmless and because they're anti-military, but they will cut off family members, shun them, you know, for the rest of their lives for adhering to a different sect that has a different color buggy or has eaves on the house. You know, those kinds of things will cause families to absolutely divide and never speak to each other again.
That's a salient feature of Scientology, which you talk about in your book, Going Clear. So it seems as if this is something that grew. I mean, the book after that, Saints and Sinners, you talk about different people, different mm-hmm. evangelists, ranging from an atheist to New Agey people to televangelists.
Right.
And there is a connection then between that and Al-Qaeda and also Scientology.
Yeah. You know, we live in a really odd country. I'm sure you're aware, but the fact is, in America, you can believe anything you want. You know, it's a supermarket of religious beliefs, among other things. And I've been in a lot of countries where that's not true. You know, you have only one thing on the menu to believe. Here, you get the choice. And so the question that I'm often asking myself is, why do people believe one thing rather than another? What draws them to this belief? And Scientology was especially interesting that way because it's such an esoteric belief system. And yet it's got so many notable personalities involved in it. And what do they get out of it besides ridicule? You know, they seem to suffer a kind of public relations martyrdom for their beliefs. And so why are they involved in it? And that was, I think most people have that question, and that's sort of what motivated me to get involved in this story.
Well, what role did Paul Haggis play, the director of Crash? Did he come to you originally for the New Yorker article, or did you go to him?
Oh, no. He was not commenting about it at all. It's a funny story about that. I've been looking for a way to write about Scientology.
By the way, did you know that Janet Reitman was doing work at the same time?
Yeah, I blurbed her book.
Oh.
So, yeah, she sent me a manuscript. When I write a big story and I get into a world like Scientology, I look for what I call a donkey. And it sounds like a, you know, disparaging term, but a donkey is a useful beast of burden. I needed someone who could carry all this exotic information that the reader needs to know and carry that reader into this world that I want to take him into. But you need a really intriguing central character to do that, and I call that person a donkey. So I was looking for my donkey, and then Paul Haggis dropped out of the Church of Scientology. He had been in for 34 years. And I was tied up on something else, but several months later, I wrote a note and said that I would be interested in writing about him. And he said, very flattered, let's have lunch on Tuesday. So I went up to New York. I said, of course, you know, this article is occasioned by your decision to leave the church. And his eyes got a little wide, but we kept talking. It was months later, after many, many other interviews, he admitted that it never occurred to him it'd be about Scientology. He was just so flattered the New Yorker was going to do a profile of him that he didn't want to allow himself to believe that. But once we launched off into Scientology as a subject, he was very courageous because Scientology has a history of being very vindictive and litigious towards its critics and defectors and towards reporters. And Paul was not intimidated by that. He says it was crazy for him to talk to me, but he did talk to me, and he provided me an entry into this very exotic world. And, you know, when I started my conversation with him, he really had not processed a lot of what had happened to him. So the interview process, which took place over more than a year, really, it was a way for him to go back through some of the thinking that led him into Scientology, which was a process of, if you will, illusioning. You know, he was gradually illusioned into the Scientology mindset, and when we began to talk, he was in the process of disillusioning. And there was a mirror of, you know, previous thoughts. And he would suddenly realize, oh, no, that's not the way the world really works. That's Scientology.
As he was doing this and as you were talking to him and having written at that point The Looming Tower and these other books, were these little sparks going off in your head about connections?
Yeah. What's often striking to me is that people that I'm writing about are usually really good people. They've been drawn into a belief system because they want to do good in the world. And even radical Islamists, even jihadists, you know, they think they're doing something for God. And it might even include sacrificing their lives. That's, you know, quite a noble impulse, except that it's done in the service of something that objectively is evil. So having the opportunity to talk to someone who is himself trying to understand what he did and why he believed what he did for such a long period of time. It was thrilling, honestly. Fortunately, Paul Haggis is an ideal central character because I wanted the reader to, you know, people say about Scientology, how could they believe, how could any intelligent person believe such a load of crap? You know, it's just, I hear that all the time. Well, here is a very intelligent, skeptical person who did believe it and felt that it enhanced his life. So if the reader isn't a little scared by that, you know, and actually confronted by the possibility that it could happen to him, then I haven't done my job.
Before we get into some of the details of the book, a couple other quick questions. Obviously, intimidation is a factor in how Scientology maintains its secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew that. In an interview in the Chicago Tribune, you said It's the goal of a reporter to stop intimidation.
Yeah. I think that bullying and that kind of thing is, you know, not every matter is going to go to, you know, the police or, you know, in the case of Scientology, the FBI has investigated some of the abuses and backed down from, you know, pursuing the investigation. But with Scientology, I rarely run into a story with as many tears in it as this one has been. You know, people who have been beaten, people who say they've been confined involuntarily for years on end, families that have been forcibly broken apart by Scientology's policy of disconnection. These kinds of things cause a great deal of unhappiness. And it's an ideal situation for a reporter to go in and find out what's going on and why is this happening. It's not so much our job to say how to stop it, and many people have asked me that, but just to air the many stories that people have and learn what's actually happening inside this very secretive organization.
Well, something has changed within Scientology, and it happened in 2009 when the head of their Gestapo, a guy named Rathbun, Marty Rathbun, left, and their chief spokesman, Mike Rinder, also left. We've also seen a whole bunch of books, not merely Janet Reitman's book, yeah, but also Mark Headley, an ex-Scientologist, the niece of David Miscavige, who's the head of Scientology, mm-hmm, has written an expose.
Mm-hmm.
Is it all falling apart?
Well,
other than the money.
Yeah. There are three aspects that hold up the Scientology tent. One is the money. And according to Rathbun and other former executives, they have $1 billion in liquid assets, mostly in offshore accounts. That's a lot of money. I mean, the Catholic Church would have a hard time coming up with $1 billion in cash. So the other thing they have in their favor, lawyers. They are, you know, they got a vast staff of lawyers, and they hire some of the best lawyers around to protect their interests. With money and lawyers, you can defend yourself pretty vigorously. What I think they're really suffering from is the lack of members. The defections at the top that you just noted are conspicuous, but I think what's also conspicuous is the absence of the ordinary members. The Church of Scientology claims 8 to 10 million members worldwide, which would, well, you know, the Mormons claim that there are like 15 million Mormons. So let's say it's, you know, almost as big as the Mormon Church. Well, it's not like that at all. If you look at data from polls where people, you know, do religious affiliations, only 25,000 Americans identify themselves as Scientologists. And that's half the number of who call themselves Rastafarians. There's perhaps 30,000 members of the International Organization of Scientologists worldwide. I don't think that encompasses the whole world of Scientology. I think there are more members than that, simply because of the number of people who come to me, or, you know, I mean, the amount of pain that I've encountered in the process of researching the book and also subsequently. You know, it's touched a lot more lives than the ones who identify themselves as Scientologists.
Well, it struck me, Lawrence Wright, it struck me that one difference between your book and Janet Reitman's book, and I think they work more as a pair rather than separately, mm-hmm, she talks about the history of Scientology in great depth. You talk about the beliefs involved and what Hubbard, L. Ron Hubbard, the founder, wrote originally. And as I was reading it, I kept thinking, you know, this sounds like almost, you know, proto-New Age talk from 1950 with Dianetics.
Yeah.
Which means he was on some level onto something.
Oh, yeah. In fact, look back at Dianetics, which, you know, he published in 1950. And it dominated the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks. It created a kind of prototype for all the self-help books that came out after World War II. That whole category, in many respects, was trying to replicate the enormous success that Dianetics had. And Dianetics is a book about self-help therapy. The idea would be that you would have a friend who would help audit you. That's the term that is used in Dianetics and Scientology. And it's not expensive. You know, with a few simple treatments, you'll be fine. Whatever is ailing you, you know, Dianetics can cure it. This swept across America like the hula hoop, about simultaneously with the hula hoop. And then it burned itself out. Hubbard made millions and millions of dollars and lost all that money. He even lost the use of the name, the right to use the name Dianetics. And so in 1954, he began the Church of Scientology, a much more carefully constructed enterprise than Dianetics had been, and he kept it very strictly under his control.
Let's talk a little about Hubbard. Obviously, his whole World War II hero story is false. I read Barefaced Messiah years ago.
Yeah.
I interviewed the author of a book about Jack Parsons, who we lived with in 1945. I was friends with a man named Alva Rogers who lived in the parsonage when Hubbard was there. Rogers, off the record to my co-host at the time, Lawrence Davidson, when we were talking to him about the history of Astounding Stories, which was the magazine he wrote about in a book, he said, I can't say this on the record, but he said, because they were both redheads, he said that Hubbard leaned over to him once and said, I'm working on something that would make P.T. Barnum look like a piker. Could that have been Scientology or Dianetics? Reitman said not, because it was too soon.
Yeah, probably not, because although, you know, he had just come from that hospital in Oakland where he claimed to have cured himself using these techniques that he developed into Dianetics. He didn't begin serious work on his thinking about Dianetics until about 1948, which was shortly after he left Parsons' household. He often said to people that he was, you know, that the real money was in religion, and you know, I'd like to start a religion because that's where the money is. So he might have been referencing that. But, you know, one thing they did say to Alva Rogers, because they were both redheads, is that that he thought that the redheads were actually the Neanderthals in modern life. And maybe modern science seems to be, I don't think it has anything to do with redheads, but lately we're thinking that Neanderthals may have just simply passed into the Homo sapiens population. So who knows?
Well, one of the things that you just said reminded me of something Harlan Ellison told me, which was that he went around to different multiple science fiction parties with those science fiction writers saying, if I was going to start a new religion, what would it be? Mm-hmm. And it was Ellison who claimed that Lester Del Rey, who was another science fiction writer, that Lester Del Rey had been a child evangelist, and he might have put it in Hubbard's head, the entire idea of creating a religion.
Well, that's an interesting thing to think about, because if you consider that after the war and after Hubbard gets out of the hospital, the first thing he does is he goes to Southern California and moves in with Jack Parsons in this sexual magic group called the OTO that were following the dictates and the writings of Aleister Crowley, this British Orientalist, a magician. I think that Crowley's writings were very influential in Hubbard's own career. But the question is, why did Hubbard go there in the first place? You know, Robert Heinlein, the great science fiction writer and Hubbard's dear friend, introduced him to that circle. So I'm curious about exactly what drew Hubbard there. What did he want to get out of that? He probably was looking for something. I mean, it could have just been for fun. But I think he was looking for some organization that he could fit into and take over. It was in his nature to try to be the person that was at the head of things. And he really admired Jack Parsons for... I mean, the guy was not only, highly esoteric religious leader, but he was the founder of the Jet Propulsion Lab in Southern California, and he has a crater named after him on the moon. So he was a really significant scientist, and I think that Hubbard genuinely admired him and wanted to emulate him. And after he left Southern California, and Jack Parsons, taking along with him Jack Parsons' girlfriend, he did begin work on Dianetics, and it was not too long after that that he started Scientology.
It seemed to me that Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance in The Master would have been a lot like what Hubbard was like.
I love the movie. I know a lot of people found it too obscure, and perhaps I'm so steeped in Scientology and Dianetics and Hubbard lore that it really spoke to me. I thought in Hoffman's performance, you could see what a compelling personality, with the strains of irrationality so deeply interwoven in that character, and yet very compelling in his way, so that people would be drawn to the sense of authority that he radiated.
I know that John W. Campbell, who was the editor of Astounding Stories and, you know, probably at that particular time the most powerful person in all of science fiction, bought into it. He bought into a lot of strange stuff.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people who you would think were more skeptical, particularly since they knew Hubbard and knew that he was a great raconteur and basically a bull artist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what Alva knew, and Alva mm-hmm. was 17 at the time.
Yeah.
You know, you would think that people like Heinlein or Van Vogt would have kind of said, yeah, Ron, that's nice, and walked away.
No, it's an interesting point because the correspondence between Heinlein and Hubbard is very revealing. In 48, 49, early 50, Heinlein was very intrigued with what Hubbard claimed to be coming up with. And he seemed to respond especially to the fact that sexual potency was heightened. But he did not seem to be in great doubt about what Hubbard was doing. He was just, you know, as far as Heinlein was concerned, it seemed plausible enough that Hubbard would do something like this. Let's take that apart a moment. You know, these guys were all a part of a similar enterprise. You know, they were creating science fiction at a time when science fiction was took itself very seriously. And, you know, Campbell said, and Hubbard echoed that, you know, the goal of science fiction was to get man off the planet, you know, get people to the moon, you know, to actually prefigure space flight and so on. And in many ways it did. You know, a lot of scientists were, as young men or young women, deeply affected by science fiction stories. And those stories helped them envision the kind of science that they would do. So in that sense, maybe Heinlein and others thought that it wasn't so big a leap for Hubbard to step from the fictionalizer into the actual scientist role.
They also dropped out pretty quickly. By 52 or so, they had kind of cut connections
yeah.
with Hubbard. So somewhere along the line, all of them, except I think Van Vogt, who stuck around a little longer, all of them walked away before the E-meter came around even.
Yeah. In part, I think that was because, you know, until the book was Dianetics was actually published, they only had exciting hints about what was coming. And then it was published, and Van Vogt and others were very, and Campbell especially, you know, very involved in Dianetics. Hubbard's own irrational leadership, I think, drove some of them away. The derision of the real scientific community also, no doubt, had an effect.
Then he became a church, and if that was his intention all along, I mean, that's a big question for me. Is that if he was going to create a science of the mind, it wouldn't be a church. And yet he also knew at the same time that if you create a church, that's where the money is.
That's right. It's interesting. Scientology doesn't even claim to be a faith. It is a technology of spiritual attainment, and one that is guaranteed if you rise up the apex of its pyramid, that you will achieve that kind of enlightenment and some superhuman powers. In that sense, you know, Hubbard always had a hard time defining it, you know, as it's not a religion, but it is a religious community. It should have a tax exemption, but it's not really, you know, it doesn't worship God. You know, there are all these internal contradictions about it. But it exists as a kind of monument to Hubbard's mentality. I mean, what Scientology really is a journey into L. Ron Hubbard's mind.
For better or worse. I mean, would you think he was a genius on some level?
I do. I think that, you know, he was, first of all, prolific. He wrote more than 1,000 books. It was Hubbard got the Guinness Book of World Records title for that. And, you know, it was all automatic writing, it seemed. You know, he would write 100,000 words a month. And in that sense, you know, something was going on with him that was really remarkable. There's a weird cohesiveness to his writings. I mean, yes, there are internal contradictions, but they aren't so profound as you might think of. You know, if he were so careless just to throw all these words out, you know, by the 100,000, you know, that you would think that it would be just easy enough to trip him up. But no, he seemed to have a real vision of human nature and how it worked. And the other thing is, if he were genuinely a con man, as so many allege, then it seems at some point he would have taken the money and run, and he never did that. He spent his whole life, most of it, alone in his room with his e-meter, elaborating the cosmology and the bureaucracy that supports the Church of Scientology.
Lawrence Wright, OT3, the Xenu story. Okay, I could understand up till that point, but suddenly when someone read that piece of paper, mm-hmm. right, which told this story, this science fiction story basically, what would be going on in Hubbard's mind? Why would he self-sabotage to that degree? Because it feels like self-sabotage.
Well, that's an interesting point because there is a much disputed letter that Hubbard wrote, apparently, in which he suggested maybe we don't need to do this OT3 thing, that we just bypass it. The church says that's not true, but Marty Rathbun, the former inspector general of the church, says that it is. OT3 is the stuff that people ridicule on South Park and elsewhere. It's a very bizarre creation story about the galactic overlord Xenu, who was dealing with an overpopulated galaxy and one very much like our own. So he, you know, brought in all these people for ostensibly for a tax audit, and froze them, put them on spaceships that looked just like DC-3s, and took them to the prison planet Tegeac, which is Earth, and dropped them into volcanoes, and then exploded them with nuclear bombs, and then their disembodied spirits were caught in nets and reprogrammed with screenwriters writing, you know, it's a very unusual. But a lot of religions have extremely esoteric beliefs. And in some ways, those beliefs serve a function. Because if you believe those things, you step across a line into a community of belief. And some of those communities are very appealing, supportive communities, like the Amish that I referenced earlier, or, you know, like the Mormons. You know, the people don't believe, you know, and the world outside does not agree that what they believe could possibly be right. But simply by saying, I do accept these beliefs, and I have subscribed to these doctrines, then you become a part of a community that may be very supportive to you. And many people in Scientology feel that way.
But on the other hand, you know, if you look at the Mormons, let's say, that's Joseph Smith in 1824 mm-hmm. claiming to be writing this book that, you know, or being given these golden tablets that are much older.
Right.
That's very different from a guy who is at first claiming to be writing a science of the mind in the 20th century. That's a very different thing.
It is somewhat different. But if you look back in, you know, Joseph Smith era, even then, you know, there were reporters around. And there's a fascinating episode occurred when Smith was in Ohio, and a mummy salesman came by I guess that sort of thing happened. but he had a number of Egyptian mummies, and he said, you know, I thought you might be interested. And Smith said, indeed. He bought the mummies and he gave them to his mother to put into a little museum. But inside the sarcophagi, there were bits of papyrus, which he alleged these were the original manuscripts of Abraham, the founder of the Judeo-Christian tradition. And he could read, he said, Egyptian. And he wrote this two books, but, you know, they're both still a part of Mormon sacred doctrine. And one of them is called the Book of Abraham. It all came out of these scraps of papyrus, which later turned up in the Metropolitan Museum. But he didn't know that at the time the Rosetta Stone had been discovered, and that ancient Egyptian was being translated into French at the same time as he was creating the Book of Abraham. What the point of that story is, he was making it up. He was confabulating it to be most charitable about it. And yet it didn't make any difference. Mormonism continues till today to be a powerful and growing denomination, even though one can look at it and ostensibly say he was lying about it.
Lawrence Wright, let's move on a little bit from L. Ron Hubbard. He eventually kind of wound up on a boat and wound up in a trailer and died. And he was replaced by a man named David Miscavige, kind of, if Hubbard is Lenin, I guess he's Stalin. Better yet, the example you give is if Hubbard's Smith, he's Brigham Young. He's Brigham Young. He comes across as a totalitarian dictator.
Well, he is the only individual that is in charge of the Church of Scientology. If you have an individual who can physically assault his other executives, as many of them had told me they have been, and then combine them in these re-education camps involuntarily, as many of them say, then it's pretty clear there's only one person who's got that kind of authority inside the church. And yet, to extend the Brigham Young analogy, there would be no Scientology today if it weren't for David Miscavige. After Hubbard died, Miscavige pushed aside the other contenders for the leadership. But by 1993, the church owed $1 billion in back taxes, which it didn't have at the time. Hubbard had decided not to pay the taxes. So this was an existential moment for the Church of Scientology. They had to get the tax exemption or they would go out of business. And so the way that Miscavige went about obtaining that was to launch 2,300 lawsuits against the IRS and individual agents, to hire private investigators to follow agents around to see who was drinking too much, who was fooling around on the road, and then publishing smear articles in the Scientology magazines. And part of the deal that was worked out with the IRS, whatever the merits of their case was, those lawsuits and the would be dropped and the private investigators called off. And the Church of Scientology got its tax exemption. And along with that comes the protections of the First Amendment of the Constitution, which are vast, you know, for religious organizations. And it is because of that that Scientology is able to survive today.
And also, there's the Tom Cruise story, because I didn't realize until I read Going Clear that in many ways he has become the face of Scientology.
He is certainly the most important Scientologist since L. Ron Hubbard. He is the reason most people know about Scientology. The celebrity angle was something that Hubbard started from the very beginning of the Church of Scientology. That's the reason that Scientology was established in L.A. That's the reason the Celebrity Center was created in Hollywood. From the beginning, the church put out a roster of prospective Scientologists that they wanted to recruit, and they included Walt Disney, Howard Hughes, Bob Hope, Marlene Dietrich, you know, some of the most famous people in the world. They were looking for that one exemplary figure that they could say, this is a Scientologist. And, you know, if they had that person, they could convert so many people. They'd never got that person until Tom Cruise came along.
Well, it could have been John Travolta.
John Travolta was their very first real conquest that way. He was not an important actor at that moment. He was in his very first movie in Mexico. And a fellow actor gave him a copy of Dianetics, and she did some auditing, some Scientology therapy on him. And he had the experience that a lot of Scientologists have when they're being audited of going exterior. In other words, he had an out-of-body experience. And that was very important to him. And then he came back to L.A., and he was in a Scientology class, and he told his teacher that he was trying out for this role in Welcome Back, Kotter. And so the teacher had the entire Scientology class orient themselves towards ABC Studios and telepathically send the message, John Travolta is right for the part, and he got the part.
There's an intimation, though, that Scientology has been blackmailing him for years. I mean, it's not up front, and you're very... very careful about it, Lawrence Wright, because of their lawyers. But the notion is that in these auditing sessions, you tell all. It's like confession. And if you're taping them, and if there's something to hide, then you could be blackmailed.
It's certainly the case. I've had sources tell me that, for instance, the church was worried that Travolta would drop out. And one of my sources said that he was a part of creating what is called a dead agent pack. In other words, compiling all the bad stuff they could find about Travolta using the things that he had said in his Scientology confessions. I don't know if Travolta really seriously considered dropping out or not. He's gone in and out of his prominence inside the church. And certainly the church has been worried about his allegiance on occasion.
They have been worried, of course, about Nicole Kidman. I guess you didn't get a chance to speak with her.
No, I wish I could. She would have quite a story to tell.
But it might have been part of her divorce contract, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, people that are associated with Scientology and with Tom Cruise in particular, many people have signed these non-disclosure agreements. And I don't know if that's true of her, but she's been very reticent to talk about Scientology because, after all, she has two children who are still involved in the church.
And they're with him, not with her.
That's right. According to Marty Rathbun, the church inculcated these children with the idea that their mother was what the church calls a suppressive person and that they should break off relationships with her.
Now, here we are, what, a year, year and a half. You had originally written this piece for The New Yorker, decided to expand it into a book, and here we are now quite a bit later. I'd like to ask you a few questions about that before we move on to a little bit about Fallaci. First of all, has anything changed since the book came out in terms of how Scientology deals with everything, or is it more or less the same today as it was a year ago?
So far, it's pretty much the same. There's defectors are, they're very harshly treated. You know, private investigators hired people that are called squirrel busters. If you're practicing Scientology and you're not in a part of the official church, they say you're squirreling. And they have these people with video cams on their heads, on their hats, go around and stake out people and knock on their doors and harass them. And private investigators who are paid to go through the trash and, monitor people with cameras. And it's very open. It's not meant to be secretive. It's meant to be harassment. And that sort of thing still goes on.
Now, what about you? Have you been harassed by them since?
No, other than lots and lots of legal letters. I've certainly gotten more acquainted with the legal profession than I'd like to be, but I haven't been sued. And the church did publish one surveillance photo of me talking to a source, but I think it was the source that they were following and not me.
So pretty much you and Janet Reitman said she'd had no issues after that either. I mean, with all of this coming out, with these ex-Scientologists all coming out, it seems to be It's not a waterfall, but certainly, you know, we're moving in the, it's a rapids, if you want to call it that.
Well, the question is, you know, has the spell been broken? Because the church really did create a chilling effect on the press because of the way it treated reporters and other defectors and so on. The lawsuits, Time Magazine fought, you know, they did an expose of Scientology in 1991 and spent a decade defending itself against illegal assaults of the church, and won at every single stage along the way, all the way up to the Supreme Court. But it was the most expensive suit that Time Magazine ever defended in its entire history. So that kind of thing does put a chill on the press. And it may be right now that the chill is beginning to come off. We'll see. I don't know how, you know, I don't know what's going to happen with my book. I've been as careful as I can be on this. I've certainly solicited the church's input and you know, made use of it where it was appropriate. But that doesn't mean that they won't decide to try, perhaps just to save face, to come after me or some other writers.
Well, what about the British edition? It had been canceled.
Yeah, my publisher in Britain got a threatening letter from a libel firm that represents Scientology in the UK. I went to Britain a couple of weeks ago, and I talked to members of Parliament at the invitation of PEN, the International Writers Association, and a group called the Index on Censorship. In the House of Lords, they're considering a bill. It's called the Defamation Act. Right now the British libel laws are kind of an international joke. It's a venue for people to go sue from all over the world because, you know, they can get judgments that people are afraid to defend simply because it's so expensive. So this law would try to remedy that, and especially inside the law, there is a special section devoted to public interest journalism, such as I do, that would make it easier for information about organizations that may be quite sinister, that, you know, people are afraid to write about in the UK. This would give people in Britain a chance to know more about what's actually going on inside these organizations.
Where is the status right now of the book? Is it still canceled over there?
Yeah, we're hoping if this bill passes, which will probably happen in March if it's going to happen, then I would like to see the book published, and maybe it would be a test case in the UK. But this is exactly the kind of book that this law is designed to allow to have published.
In your Chicago Tribune interview, you said that what you're looking at here is the dark side of extremism. Did you have any of this problem, say, with the Al-Qaeda book? Did they come after you?
Well, if Al-Qaeda had lawyers, it'd be a really dangerous organization.
So you felt a little, in some weird way, even though they kill people, you felt more secure?
I don't like to think about those kinds of things, Richard. I find that if you dwell too much on that, you won't do your job. If you do your job as carefully and honestly as you can, then there should be no reason to be sued. There's a point at which, you, as an investigative reporter, you just have to throw yourself on the mercy of human nature. And, my experience as a reporter is that most people want to have their stories told, and they want to be understood, and they're looking for an ideal, sympathetic listener. And I try to be that person. And if I can be that for them, then I think I'm safe.
One final question, then I want to talk about your other career.
Yeah.
I know that there are legal issues, so you may not be able to give details, but how much material that was as damning or more damning did you leave out? And was the reason legal, or was it just to make the book flow better?
Well, there's nothing pertinent that I left out that I thought was true. I mean, there are, in every complicated work like this one, you hear things that may be poorly remembered, misstated somehow, and if you can't verify it, then you just leave it aside. so there were stories like that that I did not include. But I didn't keep things out for legal reasons. We're blessed in the United States to have the First Amendment that allows me to write about organizations like Scientology and public figures like Tom Cruise quite openly. And, I'm very fortunate to live in this country for that reason and not in Britain.
If you were part of an organization where there were people who were ex-Scientologists who said, quote, we still believe in the precepts of L. Ron Hubbard, and they were in the organization, how would you feel about them?
Well, you know, I talked to a lot of former Scientologists who are exactly the kinds of people that you're talking about. And, of course, many religions have schisms. They disagree on doctrinal or organizational matters, and it may mean that there's a break. The Amish is a great example of that. You know, it's a very brittle organization. It breaks easily along these doctrinal lines, and I think one might say that Scientology is facing that kind of division right now. The problem that the former Scientologists have who want to continue to practice their religion is one of copyright. The church maintains copyright over all of Hubbard's writings, and that's essentially the scripture of the church. So it makes it difficult for them to do that in an open way.
And what about the ethics of what Scientology does? Should we be concerned that they've taken on Hubbard's loose ethics?
I feel like the church has a reckoning ahead of it because with all the stories of abuse that I've heard and of involuntary confinement and the exploitation of children, I think that these charges have to be answered. The church would not allow me to talk to Miscavige or other upper-level executives and put those questions to them. And I don't have the power of subpoena, so I can only talk to people that are willing to talk to me. But I think answers are demanded, and I think someone should be held responsible for these abuses.
Lawrence Wright, you're also a playwright. You've done 2 one-man shows, My Trip to Al-Qaeda, which was turned into a documentary aired on HBO, and The Human Scale, which tells the story of a conflict between Arabs and Israelis. You're now working on a play which runs through April 21st at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley, California, called Falaci, which is about Oriana Falaci, the famous interviewer who went from left to right after 9/11. And I understand this is the story of a young Iranian woman sent by the New York Times to write her obituary, who has a discussion with Oriana Falaci. How did you come to Oriana Falaci and the idea of writing this play?
Well, I was originally asked to write a one-woman show about her. And, Oriana Falaci, you know, when we were young, she was the most famous journalist in the world. And I don't know about you, but she made journalism sexy to me and made it important. And she prefigured the woman's movement. So to have this tiny Italian woman bring world leaders to their knees and have them like it somehow. I mean, that was she was able to plumb to the depths of a person's soul, it seemed. I was very affected by her. But after 9/11, she went off in this direction, this anti-Islamic screed that several of them she wrote. I felt that her views could not go unchallenged. So I decided to create another character that would carry on a relationship with Oriana. And I made her an Iranian-American, in part because I wanted a Muslim and I wanted a woman. And also, Iran was the scene of Oriana's greatest triumph, which was her interview with Ayatollah Khomeini, the first Westerner to interview Khomeini after the 1979 Iranian Revolution. And most notably, in the middle of the interview, she ripped off her chador and, exposed her hair and face to she said, I'm going to take off this stupid medieval rag, was the way she phrased it. that made a real impression on me. So after I wrote the first couple of drafts of that, I was looking at it, and I thought, you know, this woman that I've created, the Iranian-American, reminds me a great deal of Christiane Amanpour. And I know Christiane, so I sent her a draft of it, and I said I didn't knowingly copy your life, but I did think you should take a look at this to see if it's okay with you. And she got back to me, and she said, oh, my God, it's so weird. She said, in the play, you know, your character finds Oriana through Rizzoli's bookstore. I did the same thing. I went to Rizzoli's, and they helped me track her down, and I went to see her before 9/11 and after 9/11. And, you know, so many parallels that I had simply made up had actually been the case with Christiane and her relationship with Oriana Fallaci.
Maybe you've gone clear and can...
No doubt.
I understand it's gone through a lot of permutations. I mean, at one point there was an intermission, and as we're speaking, there's no intermission.
I don't think there'll be an intermission, but, you know, for me, writing, I don't know who said writing is rewriting, but that's my experience. I get a draft of a project, and I just continually rewrite it. Like Going Clear, when we finally went to the publisher, it was the 47th draft. You know, not all of those are major rewrites, but, you know, the idea that you're continually revising, and the process here in Berkeley, as I'm listening to the actors do the parts, I can see where, you know, something might be out of place, or, you know, it might be said more felicitously, or it might not need to be said at all. So all of those things are a part of the process for me during the rehearsal period here.
But there's also the idea of writing fiction itself. I mean, this event didn't happen. This woman didn't go there.
Right.
So in terms of that, does that allow you freedom? Does it tie you up? How do you feel about it?
Well, you know, even though it is fiction, I think all of my plays, and that's true, I guess, of my movies as well, you know, I like to write about real events and real people. And Fallaci's words, as much as possible, come from her writing and her speeches and so on. A lot of it is actually what she said, but it's placed into service of this conversation. I think of this, you know, my work, you know, I've done these one-man shows that are about my own experience, but I think of my work as being kind of nonfiction theater. Basically, you know, this is Oriana Fallaci. These are her words. This is the character that you encounter when you go to the theater. But the challenge I had was to make my other character as real as Oriana Fallaci. And I love that. She's based, her name is Mariam. She's based on a lot of Muslim women I've known. You know, I spent a long time in the Muslim world. I lived in Egypt, but after 9/11, I spent a considerable time working on the looming tower. And the plight of Muslim women became very vivid to me. So a lot of what I learned about that, the wounds that so many of them carry, are embedded in the character that I created for this play.
You've also are currently working on two other plays, one on the Camp David Accords. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of a similar idea of using real people with more or less what they said?
Yeah. This is the Carter-Begin-Sadat summit, the only one that ever produced an enduring peace treaty in the Middle East. And it's a great example of leadership, because it was very hard to obtain. It was 13 days in Camp David. And in order to research this, I went down to Plains, Georgia, and talked to President and Mrs. Carter. I went to Israel and Egypt and talked to the surviving members of their negotiating teams. And I read as much as I could of all the documents and books and memoirs about that period. And out of that, I compiled an account of what happened during those 13 days. And I try to make it adhere as much as possible to the real events, and they're dramatic enough. I don't have to invent too much, because it was constantly on the edge of failure.
And the other play is something about the making of the movie Cleopatra. That's a
I know. It does seem like it's a stretch for me, but I started this before 9/11. I was fascinated by, you know, when I was a young teenager, they were making Cleopatra in Rome, and suddenly Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor had this very public affair. Up until that time, I was pretty convinced that movie stars didn't actually have sex. You know, they were so carefully controlled by studios, their behavior was, you know, suddenly you have Elizabeth Taylor, who was the most famous woman in the world by far. Congress had a bill to keep her from returning to the United States. The Vatican condemned her. This was a huge, huge deal, and I cannot tell you how titillated I was by this. I think it heralded the onset of the sexual revolution. I think that was really the opening note to it. And it's also hugely funny. Because I started it before 9/11, there were still some people alive from the working on that set, and I interviewed the publicist and interviewed the son of Joseph Mankiewicz, who was the director, and the son had been on the set, and Rosemary Matthews, who was the script supervisor, and married Joe Mankiewicz. They had a romance on the set as well. So I had an opportunity to talk to a lot of the people that were there. And put it all together in this wonderful stew that I call Cleo. And I sure hope we can get a production of that because it's one of my very favorite projects I've ever had.
Last answer about God's Favorite and Noriega, God's Favorite. Now, both of them were fiction?
Yeah. You know, you remember when we invaded Panama. This was during Bush 1. And Noriega took to the hills, and then he wound up inside the Papal Nuncio's palace, and American troops surrounded it and started blasting rock music like "These Boots Are Made for Walking" and other stuff, and driving the nuns mad. But the whole idea was to try to force Noriega out of the Papal Nunciature. And I thought it was a very comic scene, and I originally thought it would be a good play. But it didn't work as a play because Noriega is a very kinetic figure, and I couldn't, I had to put him in action. And so I wrote it originally as a screenplay, and Oliver Stone was going to make it. He had actually cast the movie, and I bought a house on his assurance that he was going to make it, and then he decided not to. And so I decided I would write a novel based on it, and then unfortunately Roger Spottiswoode, another fine director, made the movie with Bob Hoskins.
Lawrence Wright, Falaci, is that eventually going to go on to the public? Because I know that Oscar Eustace is the director.
I hope so. I would love for that to happen. Oscar directed me in my one-man show, The Human Scale, in New York and Israel. And I'm having a wonderful time with Oscar here in Berkeley. And, you know, if my ambition to see the play move forward, but we certainly have got off to a good start here.
As we've been talking about this whole thing, I see two strains. One is your interest in extremism and beliefs, and the other is your work as a reporter to uncover them. You know, over this 20-year stretch, has there been anything that's changed within you that you've learned about either yourself or the human spirit, you think?
Well, I've learned a lot by, you know, pursuing the course that I have. I've been so struck by the power of belief to transform individuals and society for good and ill. I used to be very religious as a young man, and I'm not now. But I sure understand how radical changes can be brought about simply through the power of belief. I don't think we respect it enough because it can be great. It can be terribly, terribly dangerous.
And Oriana Fallaci herself, her beliefs completely shifted And that shifted who she was.
Yeah, and by she's such a powerful figure and such a great rhetorician that her language about Islam became the language of the anti-Islamic movement, especially in Europe. And, you know, the rage, well, her book was called The Rage and the Pride, you know, but the rage that she directed towards Islam and what she thought of as the assault on Western civilization, that has really framed the debate inside the West and especially in Europe.
Lawrence Wright, now you've finished Going Clear. It's out and you can kind of relax in a way about that. And you're working on your plays. You started work on another book yet?
No, I'm looking for one. This is always the hardest part for me is finding the next project. And you know, there are all these workshops about, you know, the process. But I think the big mystery in creation is knowing what you want to devote your life to. So I'm looking for that next thing.
You've been listening to an interview with Lawrence Wright, whose book is titled Going Clear, Scientology, Hollywood, and the Prison of Belief. The play Falaci is playing at Berkeley Rep in Berkeley through April 21st. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky, sitting in for Sasha Lilly on Against the Grain.